Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And I'm Philip Sage with ARMS Reliability in Australia. And today, I'd like to have an interesting conversation and debate about what we should be doing about education and preparing the reliability professionals, the maintenance managers, the asset managers of the future to be a little bit more well-founded and prepared to take their role in their job. When I started, Fred, maybe you might comment also, when I moved into the world of reliability, it wasn't because I went to university to learn reliability. One day I was anointed with a reliability word in my title, and somehow I became a reliability professional. I'd say that kind of, you know, laughingly, but I think that's very common for a lot of folks that share our passion and share our profession, is that they've come from some other background. Some have even come from working on the tools or supervision to become specialists in the field of reliability, but few, while that number is increasing, few 10 years ago for sure, had come from a university background where they had learned the academic and the theory aspects of reliability. What are your thoughts, Fred?
Well, I mean, you got reliability in your title to I was asked to, you know, do an accelerated life test, and I was in an R&D group. So my title is still R&D engineer. I didn't actually get called a reliability engineer, even though I was doing accelerated testing, reducing variability that caused field failures. I was doing lots of things in the design for reliability space for almost 10 years before I was actually recognized as a reliability engineer by title. I argue, and you gave a short list of folks that would be, you know, would need some better, a better way or more formal way of learning reliability engineering and its tenets. I would add, design engineers, industrial engineers, civil engineers, which is inherent in a lot of what they do already. I think there's a larger spread of people that need to understand and use reliability engineering concepts and tools. I don't know that it's a purview of just somebody that's going to be in the other cubicle and people throw stuff at you and say, here, make it reliable. I don't think that's an adequate way to think of it. I think it has to be a much broader than just a specialist. I think that education problem is much, much broader.
Yeah. No, and here in Australia, I guess 6 or 7 years ago, we tackled the problem head on. And I also work with Central Queensland University, and we've been delivering a reliability program at the master's level. Mm-hmm. There are a few others now that I know of, and there's probably more around the world. University of Maryland as well, distinguished in University of Tennessee in Knoxville, has had a strong reliability background and program for many years. I think a few others, including one, I think the Western Australia School of Mines, I may have got that not correct, has a reliability curriculum, but there's not, certainly 30 years ago, there weren't any. And it's not an engineering discipline that seems to be percolated throughout the academic world.
And part of it is, you know, and you understand as well as I do, the schools have to have a demand for it before they're going to build a program. So where you're teaching, and I teach one course out at Maryland, somebody said, hey, let's include some reliability engineering practices in a class, in one course. And it might have been in their aeronautical engineering, I think is where Maryland started. They had one class about reliability, and it was popular. And some people said, I want more of this. I'm interested in it. And eventually it developed into its own standalone program and department and everything else. But I think there's a demand for it. And that's why I argue that it's a broader subject, is one of the things I've read years ago, and I still firmly believe and see it every day, is that designers, the engineers, that are hardware, software, mechanical, and their management teams and the customers are designing and creating products that are not expected to fail. And the way Henry Petrosky talks about it is that they're designing away from failure. And so he uses the tenet that if you are building something and it's a new structure, new materials that you're using, it is invariably over-designed because we just don't know what the margins are. We don't know how it will respond over time or under various types of loads and stresses. So you over-design it. You load it all on. And then the next iteration is you can cost reduce it. You can analyze it and study and see how it behaves and so on. That's a reliability function. That's reliability thinking. Yet it's central to what civil engineers do. Mm-hmm. And so I think the idea of there's a lot of demand for reliability engineering. If the civil engineers, mechanical engineers, logisticians, all these different, much more popular, like MBAs, if they would understand that there are a set of tools and skills that can be taught and help to create the culture within your organization that gets you a reliable system. Whereas counting on, oh, I hired a reliability guy, we're fine. No. I don't think that works. And it doesn't matter whether you tap, Philip on the shoulder and say, hey, you're our reliability guy now, or we send you off to school for 3 years and you come back an expert. That's not sufficient. Back to the topic I think you were starting with is that I think the university stuff has a role and a place. And there's an academic development of the tools and techniques that we can use and approaches and concepts. Like a lot of work in physics of failure is being done at the university levels where they basically have indentured servants, the graduate students that run a bunch of experiments, right?
I was one of those once.
That's right. But it's one of those things that they contribute to the body of knowledge, essentially, by doing that work. And there's consortiums, there's all kinds of different ways of that's being done. But university has a role, in large part, in moving the art forward. Now, I also suggest that a brilliant maintenance manager can move the art forward.
And I agree.
I think the education part is, be careful what you ask for. If we set up a really robust and a popular set of programs that generate, 10 times the number of reliability engineers we have today, I think we're still just scratching the surface of what's really needed.
I agree. And I think the comment you made earlier about the need within industry for a higher trained reliability professional is spot on. And that's, I think, how CQU approached it through one of their industry forums. The industry experts came back and says, we really have a need to have a pool of better educated people that understand the reliability from a practical perspective and can then convert that theory into the workplace and deliver projects that are both timely and cost effective and deliver value. Mm-hmm. And so, I think, yes, it's great to understand the theoretical aspects of reliability and get deep into probability and statistics, probably deeper than many people would ever want to go. But
oh, why wouldn't everybody want to do that? You're talking, what? I thought everybody had a bookcase full of stats books. Oh, come on.
imagine we both have a bookcase. And I think you've seen mine.
I've seen yours. Yeah, I'm envious of it. You had some nice titles there.
But, I think the key is that universities can't turn out people that can't find a job. So there still has to be a demand for that and a desire for that higher level of education. And as people come up the ranks and transition out of their first reliability role or their second into, what's that next step? Is it the maintenance manager of a large mine site or operation? Or is it the asset manager role reliability role by title that is focused on some part of the operation or, you know, some part of the product line. I think in those areas, we're looking for an individual that has additional education and additional skills, but they have to be practical. And so that's why I think, we've just finished our sixth year. I just went back and looked. And each year we've got up to about 50 students that are all middle managers already accomplished reliability engineers, and we put them through the paces. And we do a couple of practical projects, a root cause analysis in the workplace, and a RCM and an availability simulation model that can be on any piece of equipment that they're available with while we introduce them to the broader range of tools that can be used in the RAMS process. So it's from a practical or pragmatic approach, it's a very, the students seem to love it. And the work that the students have done has been presented at conferences as far away as South Africa. So it's pretty fun to be part of. It's a great industry academic collaboration that involves ARMS reliability, Isograph with their availability workbench, and the reality charting from Apollinonian, and the academic setting that and the master's program that Central Queensland has crafted to address that need within industry. So it's a great partnership, but it's real interesting to think about that topic a little bit more broadly, because it's not just a problem for Australia. And as I've traveled the world, you see that need exists in every country.
Oh, I agree. It's what you've got is enough people locally said, "Hey, university, we need to do this." And they said, "Oh, okay, there's enough to try. We're going to 6 years ago, we're going to start a program, and it's got legs now, right? It's got 6 years, and another 6 years will become a bureaucracy. You'll never get rid of it." But I like the practical side. As you're talking about that story and doing projects and stuff, a lot of my stats classes, and one of them was actually taught by an Australian visiting professor, and all of our projects were, and a good number of the students in the class were working full-time like I was. And so we had a day job, and then there were a handful that were there full-time students, and they didn't have a place to go. So we always got partnered with students that didn't have a factory to go back to in the day. Unfortunately, it was my number of the operators on the floor. They'd see me come back at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, knowing I just finished an hour lecture on Wednesday after lunch, and they go, "All right, what experiment are we running today?" Because I was always going right straight from class to applying it. And fortunately, I worked in a place, and the maintenance manager he had an attitude, and it was for a whole year. The whole team had to do an experiment every single day. And it's what got a bunch of us into stats classes, and I pursued it all the way to a master's. But it was this attitude of the best way to learn it is to do it, which is that very practical piece of it.
Most definitely, yeah.
And so I was very lucky in that regard. But one of the things I ran into a few years later when I was working at Hewlett-Packard is that the reliability person that sat with the team, and I was a design for manufacturing engineer, but vast majority of the work I did was reliability work. And one day I asked the program manager of this $100 million product line development package that he was putting together for a new type of printer. I saw him one day and he asked me, "How's it going?" And I says, I feel like I'm a little out of my league. And he looked at me and I said, "I sit in your staff meeting and contribute, to these weekly meetings and many other meetings that, bringing in the reliability perspective, and plus, can we manufacture it?" And I'm a junior engineer. I'm like first level, one step above a new hire. And he goes, "Yeah, so." And he says, "All your other people are senior managers that have managers working for them. And, your hardware guy's got 25 reports." And he goes, "Yeah, so." And I said, "Yeah, so?" And he says, "Why am I on your staff?" And he said, "Because you you're the only other person that sees the entire program. You deal with software, you deal with marketing, you deal with hardware, and in all these different fields, you deal with suppliers, you deal with manufacturing. You have insights that they can't possibly have. And I bit my tongue, but I was thinking, how come I'm not being paid very much? What ended up happening? That's right. I was too young to know that. But part of it was that what HP had done is that the people that were in those roles, the people that had this kind of design for reliability, design for manufacturing roles, often got promoted to those program managers because they were one of the few people that had that broad view of the program. You know, the only thing I didn't have was the MBA to understand the finance side of it. And so people that were successful program managers for the large platform programs that were being done were basically people that were coming up through the design for type roles and a broad spectrum, and then pursued an MBA to understand the business side or something equivalent to that. And they became the folks that became the big program managers. And if they survived that ordeal, they then got promoted into senior management, you know, and did all kinds of cool stuff. But I had no idea I was on that path, and I was intimidated. And I think part of the learning is understanding the influence that understanding the business and how important what you're doing, how much of a difference it makes. And I had this conversation with a mechanical engineer that he was saying, well, everything I do is important. It's built right into the product. And he says, well, what are you working on? And he says, well, I'm trying to save, you know, half a cent per unit shipped, because if we use the same screws in two places, we save on inventory costs, and it'll net save us, you know, half of one penny per unit. And he says, oh, okay. I'm working on reducing our warranty bill by, it was equivalent to like $30 per unit ship. and I could document the savings I was making, and he could document the savings he was making. And he looked at me and went, oh, okay. So I think that's the part that, you know, I think there's a role for academics. I think there's a role for the practical stuff, and the university's picking it up is a great way to coalesce the effort and to give credence to the you know, you get a certification or a certificate or a diploma from somebody. But I think aside from that, there's still plenty of practical ways to get information. Like this boss I had that said, do an experiment every day. Let's, you know, you got to learn this stuff by doing it. But there's also the, you know, workshops and conferences and books and so on for the motivated, those that want to learn stuff. They still can. And if the certificate is, and I think my line of thought here, Philip, is that the emphasis on having a degree in a particular thing is fading. People are recognizing that just because you have a, you know, university, a blah, 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 degree in something is not as important as what you can actually do.
Yeah, it is. And the world is changing, and it's changing in many, 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 many ways. And time will tell where we'll be, you know, by the time we retire. But I agree, you know, and by doing an experiment every day, you definitely get an opportunity to learn from that that you wouldn't otherwise have if you didn't motivate yourself. And for those that don't have an option or don't choose an option down the university path, I agree that there's an awful lot that you can learn from peers at conferences, and that is available in the variety of books that are out there, depending on where your passion is. And the key, I think, you even hinted at it as a junior engineer, while you may not have totally recognized it, that manager that had put you on his team was in some ways providing an opportunity through mentoring you and giving you the opportunity to participate and learn the trade craft, if you will, of that organization. So I think the key is still the opportunity, the number of opportunities that are out there for the people that have the thirst to learn, and the mentors And whether it's a university program or it's learned by going to conferences and absorbing what other people in your industry are doing and having success with and bringing that back and trialing those ideas within your own team, as an experiment, if you will. I think all those things are aspects of what has to continue to grow in the field of reliability and asset management, maintenance management.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm going to add in the design world also. It's exactly the same. So it's one of those things that if you're listening to this and, Philip and I shared, how we got started into it. I remember it was one of our, I think it was like our 300th episode or one of the 100th episode milestones is we had all the co-hosts talk about their origin story, how they got into reliability engineering. And I don't think any of them were started off saying, instead of wanting to be a fireman, that they wanted to be a reliability engineer. I don't remember anybody going that route. But it's one of those things that, if you're listening to this, where do you think's going? One is if you need more information about the program that Philip's talking about and you're willing to participate in Melbourne, which isn't, from what I understand, all that bad of a place to be in the world. Having visited it a couple of times, and I know you live there. So it's, let us know, head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And you can get in touch with us and get more information or ask a question or share a story with us. You can also find Philip and I on LinkedIn and or on our about pages on Ascendo. Now the education world is changing. The Zoom for, grade schoolers is happening on a daily basis, even in my neighborhood, and all over the world. And we're getting used to learning online. And we also have, I should mention things like we have EDX and great lecture series. And we've got all kinds of, relatively free or very inexpensive ways to pick up things. Libraries still exist. You can go.
Yes, they do.
And find all kinds of great info there. And I hope you put on your list of professional development just for an ongoing to stay current or to learn, tap into deep dive into a particular topic. Just go to Ascendo Reliability. So I can't not mention our professional development program. And if there's something that you're looking for there, let us know. Oh, one thing before I forget, Philip, before we sign off, yes. Ascendo Reliability underneath the resources menu has higher education. And I think we have, 15 different programs that are listed around the world. I think there's a couple in China. There's two or three in Australia. I don't know whether your program is in there or not. We'll have to double check that. There's a couple in England. You mentioned a couple of them in the US. There's also Arizona State for microelectronics reliability. And there's programs that are specialized in a particular area, and there's other more generic or general purpose type programs. And so we tried to list the ones we could find and kind of what their thrust or focus was, so you could find the right match for where your interests lie. So with all of that, Philip, I think we'll sign this one off and call Zoom a success, at least for today, and we'll move forward from there.
Fantastic. Folks, follow your passion. Let us know what your thoughts are.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.